grab that cell phone, and before you start doing something, think about all the people who put computing and the world at your fingertips. A lot of men in that crowd of people. The tech industry is so male-dominated today that people often joke about the people who do the work as brogrammers with a B. But it's not all men now, and it never was. In fact, before machines did the computing, women did most of the work in calculations. Remember Hidden Figures? Women made the calculations that put Americans in space and on the moon. Women like those and many others are recognized in a new book by Claire Evans called Broadband, The Untold Story of the Women Who Made the Internet. Claire Evans writes a lot about tech and science and popular culture. Her work has appeared in Vice, Wired, and The Guardian, among others. She also makes popular culture as the lead singer of the group Yacht, and you can see Yacht's NPR Tiny Desk concert online. Claire Evans, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Starting point here, did you make some assumptions of your own about the involvement of women or lack of it in the history of computing and the internet?
You know, you would think that perhaps I might have assumed that there weren't very many women in the history of computing, but you know what? I had a feeling. Just because I know what it's like to be a woman in the world, I had a feeling that there might be some unsung heroes back there worth investigating, and you know what? I was right.
I'm not surprised that in the opening pages you describe women taking the essentially the brute force of early computing and improving upon it. Is this sort of like the fine motor skills of women improving on the coarse ones of men?
Well, I don't know if I want to get into that kind of essential description of what men and women are like, but I do think that, you know, the computing industry has not often made space for women, but wherever those spaces emerge, sometimes at the very beginnings of technologies when there's no real established precedent to draw from, or sometimes in spaces that are less privileged by the industry, spaces like software engineering and these kind of more user-oriented areas, women have found their ways in and done great things. And whether that's because it's the kind of thing that women are good at, or that's just the amount of room that was there for them is, you know, not for us to say. But I think that wherever you find women in the history of computing, you find all kinds of amazing, talented pioneers, both on the tech and on the cultural side.
I guess I expected the first story to be from 1970 or something, but instead it's from 1892, and the word computer is used. What was the circumstance?
So, you know, before a computer was a machine, it was a job. It was, you know, someone who performs computations. I think most people got hip to that from the movie Hidden Figures, but we're talking about two centuries of computational work, which was largely done by women, because it was seen as something kind of like, you know, a cottage industry thing, a kind of small scale, you know, not very serious, not very sort of highfalutin, not like being a proper mathematician. But, you know, women working together in computing offices made some of the most important innovations of our time possible. I mean, they calculated ballistics trajectories during the war. They calculated the central equations of the implosions of the atomic bomb. They calculated maritime tables and difference equations. I mean, all kinds of stuff that is really important. But, you know, the first computer programmer in history is this woman named Ada Lovelace, who was the daughter of the poet Lord Byron. And she was someone who was so fixated on mathematics that she really kind of almost willed herself into history, I think. She was a very tenacious and inspired person. She wrote mathematical proofs for a mostly speculative machine called the analytical engine, which was a very, very early prototype for a computing machine. She wrote mathematical proofs for that machine that have been characterized by many historians as the first computer programs ever written. And they were not recognized in their time because there was no language for that. But at the dawn of, you know, the computing age as we know it in the 1950s, many people working in software went back to the work of Ada Lovelace and recognized it for what it was and republished it, you know, so prescient as to be an anachronism, really. And that's she's sort of the great grandmother of all women in computing, a sort of mythical figure who had a vision of what computers could do in the future long before they even were machines.
And she was figuring out how Charles Babbage's work could go further. Now, this is before the light bulb. So, I mean, what did it take to build Babbage's machines?
Well, Babbage had these two machines, neither of which was fully completed. He was a very ambitious man and not very good at communicating what he wanted to do with the funds that he got from the British government at the time. The first machine, the difference engine, was designed to calculate polynomial functions, which was useful in maritime navigation. The second one was a bit more abstract. It was called the analytical engine. And instead of calculating numbers, it could calculate variables. So anything that could stand in for any variable could be calculated by this machine. These are not, this is before the light bulb, you're right. So this is not like anything we can think of as being a computer today. It looks more like, I mean, they call them engines, and that's a pretty good analogy. If you look at a photo of the analytical engine or the difference engine, the little bits and pieces that were constructed and reconstructed, it looks like something, you know, looks like a bank vault or a steam train. It looks like something mechanical, like really a machine. And, you know, with lots of interlinked brass cogs and little pistons and tiny parts, it took a level of metal machining that was far ahead of its time.
So really tight tolerances to make sure that it. Is it fair to say there were really tight tolerances with this stuff? I mean, everything had to be exactly the right size?
Yeah, everything had to be exactly the right size, which is part of the reason it was never constructed, because the British government granted Charles Babbage some funds to build the first one because they thought that, you know, tables of polynomial functions might be useful for, you know, British scientists and maritime navigation. But he ended up spending 10 times as much and never really had much of a machine to show them. So this is something that, you know, they tried to do by mechanical means, things that wouldn't be possible for another century or so.
We are talking about the women who did amazing things with machines and ultimately with computers themselves, all recounted in the book Broadband, The Untold Story of the Women Who Made the Internet by Claire Evans, who has done some work in tech herself and certainly has covered it many times for the likes of Wired and Vice and The Guardian. We'll come back and talk more about the people that she covers in the book Broadband and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us. We'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Claire Evans, who has written a book about women in computing and the Internet. Her book is called Broadband, The Untold Story of the Women Who Made the Internet. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to understand a little better the relationship between Charles Babbage, who came up with these ideas for mechanical computers in the mid-19th century, the difference engine and the analytical engine. And I kind of cringe at the term he used for Ada King, the Countess of Lovelace, his interpretress. What did that mean?
Well, Charles Babbage was one of these kind of famously cantankerous historical figures. He was not good at engendering public goodwill or the support of the people that he hoped would fund him. He believed so strongly in his importance that I think he rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. Ada was fascinated by him and fascinated specifically by his machines, which she thought she could be of great service to, because she not only sort of served as a little bit of a social buffer, helping, you know, try to make introductions and soothe some of the interactions that he had with other people, but also as, an interpretress. I don't think that's necessarily a bad way of describing her. She was able to formulate a vision for what his machines could actually do and how they could change the world, which was something he, you know, wasn't always great at communicating with the public. So her role was kind of, she was a mathematician who also had a vision for the application of computing machines beyond just their value as feats of engineering. She was able to communicate what they could do, how they could be used to process, you know, abstractions, not just numbers, but possibly in the future, musical notes and ideas. You know, she was very kind of had this sort of metaphysical, poetic spirit because her father was Lord Byron. So perhaps she had a little bit of his poetic spirit. But she was a great communicator and a great interpreter of the computational idea. And she wrote some notes for the operation of the analytical engine that were far, far ahead of their time and contained the earliest practical computer programs for those machines.
Are the concepts in some respects still present today?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the analytical engine, you know, contained the sort of core components of modern computing. It had a memory. It talked about memory and talked about processing, and it separated those things. it made the major conceptual leap, which is that, you know, early computing machines were arithmetic machines. They were designed to crunch numbers and only numbers, very specific functions. They could only do one thing. What kind of ushered in the computing age is the idea of a general purpose machine, something which could process more than just the one task that it was designed to do, but any potential task for which you could write software. So, you know, the analytical engine was the first of those machines because it thought of, instead of numbers, it worked in variables. So you could, anything that a variable could stand in for could conceivably be processed. And that's how computers operate today. You know, a computer can do anything you can write a program for it to do. It's not a static piece of hardware. It's something which evolves alongside of us. And that's why it's become such a powerful, you know, symbolic and literal force in our world.
I'm still fascinated by the idea that women were hired as computers as the 19th century went on. Was this seen as secretarial work or something? Because it also did take some brain power. And, of course, this is a time in history when, particularly in the late Victorian age, when people were thinking in terms of, you know, women shouldn't learn X because it might hurt their internal organs and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, even Ada Lovelace was diagnosed with what people called hysteria in those days because, you know, she was such an unusual person, they couldn't make sense of it. But yeah, you know, it's computing, people who worked in computing offices doing menial computational work, you know, up through the beginning of the actual mechanical computing age, what they were doing was little pieces of arithmetic. They were, much like a computer does today, breaking big problems into smaller pieces and processing those pieces in parallel. So groups of people working together could do large, complex mathematical things that individuals could not do alone because they would break it into steps. And so, you know, women were working in those roles because, yeah, it was seen as kind of a menial sort of clerical job, a secretarial job, if you will, something that didn't have the same value as being a mathematician. And yet these women working together, I would argue, sort of form the first computer networks because here they are working in parallel together to do something that's greater than the sum of their parts. And that's a pretty powerful thing. And, you know, when computing machines became a presence around World War II, the people who were hired to run those machines and operate those machines and come up with how to program those machines were the women who had already been doing the math for as long as anybody could remember. So they were tasked with the job of taking what they were doing and putting it onto the machine. So essentially replacing themselves with the machine, but in the process inventing this new category, which was the computer programmer, the person who actually translates that mathematics into something that is, you know, can be processed by a machine efficiently, and consequently, you know, invented the entire domain of computer programming. So, you know, it's a lineage that begins with these computing offices of people doing, you know, perhaps individually, quote unquote, insignificant work, but it daisy chains into something much more complex. And we find ourselves now in an information age that is founded by that collaborative mathematical work.
Claire Evans writes of women and their contributions to computers in Broadband, the untold story of the women who made the Internet. So you were just talking about the women who did the computations, but then led to the machines that replaced them. Grace Hopper is a huge figure in this book. Tell us a bit about her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's really one of my favorite historical figures, period. She called herself the third programmer of the first computer, which is a fair enough assessment. She was a mathematician. She taught mathematics at a graduate level before World War II. And then when Pearl Harbor happened, she decided to enlist. As a mathematician, she thought that when she enlisted in the Navy, that she would be sent to go crack codes in the cryptography labs of the Navy. But instead, she was taken to Harvard, where she was presented with the first electromechanical computer in the United States, the Harvard Mark I, which had no manual, no instruction set. She was told, okay, here are these ballistics problems that we need to crunch for the war effort, get to work. She had nothing to learn from other than the machine itself. So if you can imagine this, you know, here's a person who's never heard of a computer because there hasn't been one before, coming face to face with this room-sized contraption full of exposed wiring and churning parts, and having to understand how to take a mathematical problem and put it into this insane machine. She ended up essentially bootlegging an engineering education by looking at engineering schematics, looking at wiring diagrams, taking bits apart, eventually understanding the machine as well as the people who created it, and developing processes by which the machine could be operated and run 24 hours a day, like a submarine, basically, during the war, processing some of the most important computational problems of the war, which, you know, were ballistics problems. They were problems of physics relating to nuclear bombs. They were problems of cryptography, yes, as well, but, you know, big, major world-changing problems that hopefully saved lives. And in doing so, she invented a form of computer programming. And in labs like that all around the United States and the UK, women were doing the same thing because women were really pretty much hired across the board to run these machines.
I had to smile at Grace figuring out not just the machine, but also the wiring of her commander.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, the man who invented the Mark I was another kind of irascible figure, very similar to Babbage. In fact, very influenced by Babbage. The Mark I was designed with some of the core concepts of Babbage's machines in mind, and he was just as thorny of a character. He, the day that Grace Hopper showed up at Harvard to figure out how to run this machine, he said, "You know, have you found a place to live yet?" And she said, "No." And he said, "Well, you'll figure it out tomorrow. Get to work." That was kind of his attitude. He, you know, he worked people to the bone. It was the war, you know, so I think he was driven by the sense of purpose. But he kept this computation laboratory. He ran it like it was a Navy, you know, a Navy organization. So everyone referred to the computer as her, like you do with a Navy ship. Everyone wore full uniform. Everyone was to call him commander. And they worked in this brisk and military fashion, doing math in a basement at Harvard for many years until after the war, which is quite an amazing scene to imagine.
So one of the amazing things about Grace Hopper is she figured out a process to not have to write the same code over and over again. This is a really key thing for what came after her.
Yeah, it's so hard to think about this now, because when we think about computer programming, we imagine typing and keyboards and screens. That's kind of a symbolic kind of work. But in those days, computer programming was really done at the machine level. So it was a question of, you know, flipping switches and punching cables into each other and punching holes into cards in octal 8-bit code and putting them into this machine. It was very kind of menial and task-oriented. And if you wanted to do something, you know, if you had a problem you had to do, you had to always write it from scratch. There was not like the idea of repurposing old code to save time. And Grace was one of the first people to say, "Hey, we already wrote this little piece of code here. Why don't we just recycle that? We'll call it a subroutine, and we'll put it together with all the other subroutines that have already been written and already been debugged, and we'll make a sort of higher level program out of that." And that kind of leap from the individual bits of code punched into paper to thinking about computer programming and coding as something that could be sort of a collection of other interlinked pieces operating together at a kind of a higher symbolic level was something that she spent her whole career pushing for. And after the war, you know, even as men were returning from the front to reclaim their places in American academic institutions and throughout the home front, she stayed in the industry, and she pushed for what was then called automatic programming, which is just the general idea that programmers should move beyond the menial kind of, you know, the sort of dark priesthood of knowing how to flip all these switches and begin to think about things like programming languages, which were an even higher level of operation. So she made a huge contribution to, you know, the development of programming as we know it today. If it wasn't for her and people like her, we would still be, you know, punching holes into cards and flipping switches in the belly of these massive machines. And she made that big leap.
There are pictures in the book, I should point out, too, of people who are actually unplugging and plugging things in to reconfigure the computer, because that's what you had to do with these room-sized machines back then. Claire Evans, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, her book about the contribution of women to computers and the Internet is called Broadband, The Untold Story of the Women Who Made the Internet. You're welcome to join the conversation on the Exchange. Questions or comments, welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned way back in the program about you know, missile trajectories and things like that. And is this primarily what Grace Hopper and her team were doing with the Mark I and Mark II at Harvard?
Yeah, ballistics were a big part of wartime computation, because during the war, you know, the government was producing weapons faster than it could produce instructions on how to use them, and they were sending them to the front. But in order to be able to shoot an artillery shell, you had to understand, you know, at which angle the weapon had to be placed in order for the weapon to land for the ballistic shell to land where you wanted it to land, which is a complicated kind of physics problem that involves differential equations. And so that's what a lot of the computational work during the war was building these ballistics tables that soldiers could use to determine the angle of their weapons.
So the Mark I and Mark II computers at Harvard were mechanical clickers and clackers. You pointed out the ENIAC machine, though, was a different breed. What was that about?
Yeah, computing history, it's funny. I mean, it's very difficult to say what was the quote-unquote first computer because there's all these different kinds of qualifiers. I mean, the Mark I was, as you say, a mechanical. So it had had pistons and moving parts. But the ENIAC, which was a computer developed at the University of Pennsylvania pretty much simultaneous to the Mark I, was the first electrical. So it no longer had these mechanical components. Instead, it was doing computation using vacuum tubes. Like little light bulbs, and the vacuum tubes floating on and off were the way that it operated rather than through mechanical means. So this sort of decoupled computing from the mechanical and allowed us to enter into the more modern age of things processing very, very rapidly. Ultimately, the ENIAC and the Mark I sort of operated at the same speed at the end of the day because it took a lot more time to put programs onto the ENIAC. By the time you have a program set up on the ENIAC, maybe the Mark I would have done the whole thing and been on to the next. But, computing history is something that develops kind of sideways sometimes. And anyway, we haven't gone back to mechanical machines, that's for sure.
No, we haven't. Now, we get to meet in this part of the book, Betty Jean Jennings and Betty Snyder. They were true pioneers. What were the things they did with ENIAC?
Yeah, I mean, like Grace, these were women that were tasked with figuring out how to run a machine that they had never seen or heard of before in their lives. Like Grace, they had to sort of take it apart to understand how it worked. But they were super interesting because they were hired from an office of human computers. They had been doing manual ballistics trajectories using slide rulers and differential analyzers and these kind of old school arithmetic machines. And they arrived at the ENIAC and came up with some of the earliest programs to effectively demonstrate, what the machine could do. Ultimately, the war ended before they were able to use the ENIAC in wartime applications, but they were responsible for creating the first program that was demonstrated on the ENIAC, which is sort of the earliest demonstration of a computer program that people knew about in the press, because these computers were secret during the war. They were, they were classified. So after the war, the Western world's introduction to computers as a concept came from the ENIAC. The ENIAC was the first famous computer, and the programs that it ran in its earliest demonstrations were written by Betty and Betty, the two Bettys who were programming partners. And later on, after the end of the war, they both ended up working at the earliest commercial computer company, creating some of the fundamental software for the UNIVAC, which was the first commercially available computer at that scale.
Betty Snyder in particular got a rep for sleeping on a tough problem. How did that work for her?
Yeah, she was one of those people who, her mind could untangle knots in her sleep. I wish I was like this. I mean, this is a really powerful trait to have. There's a famous story about Betty and Betty programming the ballistics trajectory for the ENIAC, a very important program. It took them a couple of weeks to do. It was going to be the program that was used to demonstrate the ENIAC to all the military brass and to the press and to all these important sort of hoity-toity, highfalutin types that were their bosses. And they got stuck on it because they managed to figure out how to make the computer shoot the ballistics trajectory, but then once the imaginary bullet hit the ground, they couldn't figure out how to stop it. So they couldn't figure out how to stop the computation after the bullet was supposed to strike its endpoint, which made it useless. It made it worse than useless because the bullet just kept going into the earth, and that's a useless computation. So they were stuck, and the very night before they were supposed to demonstrate it, they had to give up because they couldn't figure out what to do. And they went home. And Betty Snyder went to sleep, and she dreamt the answer, which what a fantastic thing. She dreamt the answer. And the next day she arrived at the lab, and she flipped one switch in the right direction, and she fixed the whole thing. And the program ran without a hitch, and it was demonstrated to all the highest-level military people who had funded the ENIAC, and it was the sort of introduction of computing to the modern public and people. Read about it in the New York Times the next day. And it's, of course, they weren't pictured in any of the photos, of course, or written into any of the history books for, 50 years after that, but they were the ones that figured it out.
Well, that's what I was about to say. This should have been a moment of triumph for Betty and Betty, but as you point out, history would run them over again and again.
Yeah, unfortunately, they were written out of the first history to be written about that machine in that time, and then they were consequently written out of the next ones to come, because everyone, historians build on the work that comes before, and it wasn't until they were in their 80s and finally so exasperated that they had been ignored that they began to tell their own stories and then had a moment of great triumph at the end of their lives where they were awarded many awards by various computational societies for their contributions. But it took a really long time, and it took them claiming their own space because no one gave it to them.
I was going to ask this. So given the lousy press coverage at the time, it sounds like it wouldn't have been easy to find evidence of them in accounts back then, but they rectified the difference themselves late in life?
Yes, with the assistance of some wonderful historians.
All right, we'll talk more about Betty and Betty, and actually Betty and Betty meet Grace Hopper in the next segment we'll talk about here in Broadband by Claire Evans. It's the untold story of the women who made the Internet, and obviously computers before that. So a lot more to talk about, a lot of involvement from women over the years in the computing devices leading up to what we have in our hands today. Claire Evans, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of the book. We'll come back and talk more about Betty, Betty, and Grace, and all the other women when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're having a fun chat with Claire Evans, who is a writer about tech and science and popular culture and the lead singer of the group Yacht. You can see Yacht on NPR's Tiny Desk Concert online. But we're talking about Claire's work in print right now. She's written a book about women who did amazing things that helped computers be what they are today. Her book is called Broadband, The Untold Story of the Women Who Made the Internet. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So this is fun. We get to see some of our heroes actually meet in the book. So you get Betty Jean and Grace Hopper all working together. Where was that, Claire? Oops, we seem to have a little bit of cell phone wander. Can you come back
able
to
here we go. Where she had been working.
Okay, now we can hear you.
Hello?
Yeah, we're there. Yeah. Well, we could.
No. Grace Hopper was able to peek her head out of been working and discovered that she wasn't the only woman working. In fact, there were women all around the United States working at similar installations. The closest to her were the group at the University of Pennsylvania, which included Betty and Betty. And they met, they became friends, and after the war, all went to work at the same computer company, the first commercial computer company, the first company to seriously consider creating computers for commercial use, not just for military use or for the government, but to sell to companies for their various information problems. And, you know, because the only people in the world who knew how to computer program, who invented computer programming, were women. They ran all the software engineering teams at this company, which was called the Eckert Mockley Computer Company, and Grace and Betty and Betty and a number of other women worked together, developing the operating system essentially for the super early commercial computer, the UNIVAC, which was synonymous in its day with computing itself. I mean, the same way that we say Kleenex to mean tissues, or, Xerox to mean photocopiers, the UNIVAC, meant computing in the 1940s. And they created all kinds of powerful pieces of software for this machine for the duration of their careers.
I'm still fascinated by the concept of a computer company cropping up after the war. I mean what kinds of applications did they foresee people buying their computers for, and could they produce them that fast?
Yeah, well, they couldn't produce them fast enough for the demand, unfortunately, but there were a lot of applications for any kind of calculation-intensive industry, like aviation, for example, or insurance, or even, the payroll operations of any large corporation could have been assisted by the presence of a rapid computing machine, especially with software tailor-made for the operations at hand. I mean, some of the earliest customers of the Eckert Mockley Computer Company were people like, the Census Bureau or large insurance companies, Northrop Aviation. People that had, the funds and the resources to buy what at the time was a very expensive, very intensive machine with custom-made software designed by the women leading the computational teams.
The UNIVAC name held on for a while. In fact, I know people who got called UNIVAC because they were brainy people well up into the 60s and 70s. So it really stuck out. So how great an advance was UNIVAC over ENIAC or the Mark 1 and 2?
UNIVAC was a big leap. You know, a lot of these really early machines were punch card operated. So they had, you know, the code was still punched into physical cards, which is something that IBM, you know, continued to do for some time afterwards. But the UNIVAC used magnetic tape, which allowed for more rapid processing, allowed for far more storage. It was much more complex. It could operate at a couple higher levels than the punch card machines could. Unfortunately, it was a little bit too far ahead of its time. You know, people weren't ready to get rid of the punch cards quite yet. I think for office contracts, the punch cards were kind of comforting because they were, you know, this material thing that you could hold on to and keep records of, whereas magnetic tape was a little bit, you know, opaque, literally, and unknowable. So it was something that didn't quite, you know, make the impact that they had wanted. There was a lot of competition ultimately in the field, but it was leaps and bounds more powerful than any other machine at the time of the most advanced computers in the world.
Now, there were some choices getting made that led up to the machines that we know in our time. And you mentioned a link between one of Betty Snyder, then Betty Snyder Holberton's decisions, and a computer you had, that Dell you mentioned at the beginning of the book.
Yeah, it's a little thing, but Betty Snyder Holberton is remembered for a handful of things, but one of the things that comes up in every obituary ever written about her was that she was the first person to suggest that a computer should be beige, because those early UNIVACs were black and gray. They were steel. They were just like these big mechanical things. And she was the first person to say, hey, what if this is a little bit of a friendlier color, something that could blend into, you know, our domestic environment a little more. So we have her to thank for the beige color of all of our desktop computers up until quite recently.
I don't know. They all started turning black all at once. But, yeah, before that, all so much beige. In fact, I should point
so
out that the picture of you in the book, Claire, looks like a very early Apple.
Yes. I'm a collector of vintage computers, obviously. I mean, I think that comes as no surprise. But I'm a big fan of picking up some of this old hardware. And, in fact, you know, in the process of writing this book, you know, I think I'm technically a millennial. I grew up online. I remember computers as being part of my life from the very beginning. But there are certain things where, you know, if your brain was formed in the years of the World Wide Web and of the sort of modern computing, it's kind of difficult to unlearn and think about what people were dealing with and building, you know, before that. So one of my great hobbies is buying old computers and just using them to understand what it was like. I think it helps me articulate the experiences of the people that were developing that software, developing that hardware. It's also a lot of fun. There's all kinds of amazing, you know, old programs and games to play with on a machine like that.
It took a lot of patience to work with those machines. You notice that?
Yeah. Well, you know, it makes you realize how impatient we are now. I mean, just waiting for a classic Macintosh to boot up, you know, the amount of things you could get done in that time, it's pretty remarkable.
Truly. Now, Grace Hopper, in fact, gets some credit here for not wanting to think of programmers as a priesthood. What did she want that relationship to be?
Well, you know, these early programmers, what they did was so arcane and calculation intensive, and I mean, they were mostly mathematicians and people who had pretty limitless patience to deal with these minutiae of early code, you know, systems. It was a lot different than it is today, and they thought of themselves as a priesthood because what they did was kind of like the dark arts of computing. But Grace understood that there was no way that computers were going to have an impact on the world if people, regular people, didn't have an opportunity to use them. I think she knew early on that, you know, the greatest things in computing would emerge from, you know, the everyday user interacting with these machines. So her number one priority after the war was coming up with ways to make computing accessible to people who are non-programmers and helping a next generation of programmers enter into this kind of daunting field. And she did that by, you know, starting to think of the programmer as not someone who's flipping switches down in the belly of the machine, but working in a kind of much more sort of symbolic level. So she pushed for this thing people at the time called automatic programming, just the idea that, you know, programmers should take a step up and start to build intermediaries between themselves and the machine. That involves things like compilers, generators, and early programming languages themselves. All of these mechanisms that allow us to think about software in a more abstract way and allowed for the development of software engineering as an art form, I would argue, as a language, as something with as much power to transform the world as the actual boxes themselves.
So she really was about asking computers questions in English and having them be able to answer those and change themselves, too, to conform.
Exactly, yeah. Natural language was very important to her because, you know, if only mathematicians can use software, then what good is that going to do? There's a small amount of mathematicians in the world, and there's lots of people that speak language. So I think she thought it was very important to be able to make commands in natural language and to have programs which could work not just on one machine, not just on the UNIVAC or the ENIAC or the IBM, but on all machines. So she really pushed for this idea of machine independence, programming languages that could be used on all of the hardware available, which allowed software to kind of progress alongside the hardware industry in the history of computing and not get tied to individual machines and held back by the limitations of individual machines.
So along the way, though, we had to have COBOL and a couple of other computer languages in there. I love the snark you include about COBOL. It was apparently not universally loved.
No, it's one of the, I mean, you know, all these old thorny programming languages, you know, there are devotees and adherents and fans, but there are also plenty of people that can't stand them. COBOL is one of the earliest machine-independent programming languages and one of the first it represented this really interesting ceasefire where all the different computer companies got together and agreed that they needed a shared language rather than, you know, a Tower of Babel situation where nobody could comprehend it, what anyone else was doing. But it was designed by committee and it was designed by a bunch of different people with different interests. So it's a kind of a strange computer language, but it was incredibly important in the development of the computing industry. And, you know, to this day, a large amount of the code in the world is still written in COBOL.
So we can trace the fact that women were involved, obviously doing all the computing before machines did the computing. Oh, I think I just answered my own question. It was going to be what happened to the women then. Well, once the machines did the work, they didn't need the women anymore.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's some of that. I think the generation after Grace and Betty and these people, once Grace and Betty aged out of their fields, I mean, they held on for a long time. Grace was still working into her 70s, but you know, there was sort of a shift that happened after that, where as computer programming became more professionalized as an industry, there was the introduction of a number of, you know, educational requirements. Because it used to be that programmers were self-taught. They wandered in, you know, from their various disciplines and found an aptitude for this and excelled out of sheer talent. But as the industry became sort of more formalized and more lucrative, you know, there was an establishment of you need to have a computer science degree, you need to be a member of these various engineering societies, and that kind of professionalization ultimately edged women out because not all women were coming at it from this very linear kind of, you know, I go to engineering school and I graduate with the right kind of degree sort of way. I mean, it didn't really make space for people that, for example, might have to leave school to raise a family and then come back. So, you know, this and a number of other factors edged women out of the industry, plus the usual stuff, you know, wage discrimination and a lack of support for childcare obligations, et cetera. But we entered into kind of a period of masculinization, which is really sad because, you know, in the 1960s, women were pretty much half of the workforce in the computing industry. And
wow.
Up until the mid-80s, women were earning, I think, 40% of computer science degrees in universities in the United States. So, you know, there's nothing natural about the state of affairs of imagining that tech is a male-dominated environment. It's a fairly recent phenomenon that tech is so male-dominated. And I think, you know, there's been lots of speculation and hand-wringing as to why exactly we saw this huge drop-off. I think it's concentration of a lot of factors. But it's important to remember that it is not the natural state of affairs. And in fact, women are, you know, computing is absolutely the domain of women, not exclusively, but it is a domain in which women should feel comfortable and should feel like, you know, it is our country as much as anybody else's.
Let me get another name or two in before we go. Jake Feinler. Why was she called Jake and what did she do for the early days of the Internet?
I don't know. Her friends called her Jake. I don't know why exactly, but her real name was Elizabeth, but everyone called her Jake. And she's another interesting character because the development of the Internet, I mean, when people started actually connecting machines to each other, so beyond just doing programming, actually connecting these machines together so that people could program at a distance, computer scientists could use resources remotely. That was a very, very masculine environment because it was developed by the Department of Defense. for, you know, advanced computer scientists and engineers in academia, so two very, very male-dominated environments in the 1970s. But there were women involved in this kind of interesting sideways capacity. So the entire internet, as it stood in the 1970s, in the earliest days of its connection to itself, there was no interface for it. There was no search engine. If you wanted to use a resource on the internet, you had to know where it was. And in order to know where it was, you had to call this office called the Network Information Center, which was at Stanford. And it was run by this woman, Elizabeth Jake Feinler, who was kind of an information scientist, a secretary, a librarian, an air traffic control, a one-woman Google of her day. She knew where every node on the network was. She maintained the kind of white pages of the early internet. She had all of the technical documentation. If somebody wanted to join the internet, if a new node wanted to be added to the internet, they had to call her office first and make sure that, you know, the paperwork was in order, they had their protocols right, you know, everything was set up to go, and she would give them, you know, space on the internet. So she was like the ur administrator of the entire early network. For 20 years, if you wanted to know something about the internet, you would call this number and she would answer and tell you what to do.
Wow.
So
it's just
pretty
incredible. Yeah, one of many amazing stories in the book, and I bet you had a lot of fun putting it together.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I got to meet all my heroes. Isn't that the dream?
That really is. The book is called Broadband, The Untold Story of the Women Who Made the Internet. It's by Claire L. Evans, who's been our guest today on the Jefferson Exchange. Claire, thanks a lot.